This is major prophets. The goal is to get to the end of Jeremiah and then do that brief overview of Lamentations. And that might sound like a lot, but it's not as much as it seems. There's a lot of material in the final prophecy of the book, chapters 50 and 51, but we're going to skim over that. In essence, it's about Babylon. And it's believed by many to be dual prophecy, meaning the ancient city of Babylon. But in as much as any of it is end time prophecy, it's talking about mystery Babylon the Great, as Revelation calls the beast power, or that end time last reincarnation of the Roman Empire. But in this part of Jeremiah, it's not always clear which is which. So I like to focus on the ancient fulfillment and realize that it might give us some details about the future fulfillment that we're not sure of. Now, I already mentioned chapter 50 and verse 1. You know, there's this reference to Babylon and Chaldeans. In the previous class, I mentioned that, okay, there's the city of Babylon, then the bigger region, Babylonia, and then Chaldea. And the Chaldeans were an ethnic group that were part of Babylon. We go on from there. You know, there's the instruction to Jeremiah, declare among the nations, proclaim, set up a standard, say Babylon is taken. So the overall essence of the prophecy is simple. Babylon is going to fall. Babylon will be conquered. And there's word after word after word expounding on that. It mentions Bel is shamed, Merodach broken in pieces. These are both names of false gods. Bel is a shortened form of Baal, B-A-A-L. You see Baal in the Bible a number of times. Merodach is sometimes rendered as Marduk, the chief god of the Babylonians. So Marduk, we believe Merodach is saying the same thing. So her idols are humiliated, images broken in pieces. Yeah, they're just man-made objects. One of the things I find amusing, and I think I've got it written out in my notes another place, the Hebrew word that's usually translated idol, I believe, is gilul, G-I-L-L-U-L. It's the Hebrew word for dung pellets, yeah, or turds. And God is saying that's what he thinks of these idols. They're pieces of feces. So I think it's God's sense of humor perhaps coming through. You guys think it's amusing too. Okay, verse 3, for out of the north comes a nation against her, which shall make her desolate. If you look at the map here, remember we just saw Babylon is about as far north as Jerusalem. They would be conquered by what empire? We often say the Persian or Medes and Persians, which they are up here. That's the center of them. So they are going to come from the north against Babylon. So that was quite literally fulfilled. How does this refer to end time? That's not as clear a question. I'll just leave it open. Some people say, well, Babylon, if it's Rome, it's not something from the north. Some suspect that in the turn of events that's described in Revelation, where the river Euphrates is dried up and this 100 million man army comes from the east, that might be a reference to this. And notice I'm speaking in very tentative terms because our understanding of it is very tentative. We do know that the Medo-Persian Empire came from the north and conquered Babylon. If you look ahead to before we go further, to verse 4, in those days and at that time, those are phrases that often refer to the end time. So in those days and at that time, the children of Israel shall come. They and the children of Judah together with continual weeping, they'll come. If this is an end time fulfillment, that seems to be referring once again to the conversion of those descendants of Israel when Christ returns. Those who are alive will come with weeping. They'll understand that this is God and they'll turn to him, which fits with the command in verse 8. Move from the midst of Babylon. We're going to see that several times within this prophecy. Get out of Babylon. You can see it again in chapter 51, verse 6, 51, verse 45. It matches clearly with a prophecy back in Isaiah. Isaiah 48, verse 20 has a command, get out of Babylon. That was Isaiah 48, 20. But what we will remember most significantly is in Revelation. Revelation chapter 18, verse 4, where it says, come out of her, my people, lest you share in the plagues. So that's a repetitious theme. If this Babylon is representative of the antithesis of God's way through the ages, God's command to his people is always the same. Come out of there. Don't be a part of that. In ancient times, when Babylon was conquered, remember, a lot of the Jews were there because they'd been taken there in captivity. So it could be a warning in ancient times, get out of there because the Medes are coming and the Persians, and they're, you know, a lot of the Babylonians will be killed. I'm not worried about that myself because I'm not in Babylon. But as far as the end time, that religious system that is counterfeit, counter to God's way, that's something we don't want to be a part of. So we have a command to get out of that, stay away from it. Looking ahead, beginning in verse 9, there's several verses that mentions an assembly of great nations from the north coming together. And I'll just mention, in ancient times, the Medes and Persians cooperated, but they also had other nations joining with them, many of them as mercenaries. Hey, I'll go fight for whoever pays me. That's been something that's happened throughout human history. Let's note verse 13 of chapter 50. Because of the wrath of the Lord, she shall not be inhabited, but she shall be wholly desolate. Let me give you some other verses that say some similar things. Later in this chapter, verses 39 and 40, matter of fact, I can just turn over there. Verse 39, therefore the wild desert beast shall dwell there with jackals and ostriches. In chapter 51, verse 43, Jeremiah 51, 43, says, her cities are a desolation and a dry land and a wilderness. Okay, there's another one I won't turn to, but it's worth noting in Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 13, verses 19 to 22, is a pretty elaborate prophecy saying Babylon is going to be utterly desolate. It'll be abandoned. No one will live there. I want to pause and make it clear this was not fulfilled immediately in ancient times. You know, you can read the account in Daniel, you know, the same chapter that has the handwriting on the wall, the Medes and Persians will conquer Babylon, but because they were able to divert the river and send people underneath the gate and open the gates, they didn't have to destroy the wall or break through, and they didn't destroy the city. Rather, the Persians captured it and used it. And Cyrus would even make it a place that he would live some of the time. Sometimes he used it as a winter capital. So later the city gets some destruction. Xerxes will sack the city and cause some of the destruction. But it won't be until Roman times. During the Roman Empire, the city of Babylon will finally fall into destruction. So that's why I mentioned, you know, in 1 Peter that Peter seems to be in Babylon. But in the time after that, it'll eventually be destroyed, and it'll turn into wasteland, and it'll be lost for a long time. And to this day, it's not an there's not a city where Babylon used to be. People argue about that prophecy in Isaiah where it says no one will live there, because there have been archaeological camps, you know. So people say, well, the archaeologists have set up tents and lived there temporarily while they're digging up, getting that gate, you know. What is the Ishtar Gate that Mr. McNeely likes to show us pictures of? So people have been there doing excavations. And that leads some people to say, okay, this has been partly fulfilled, but maybe it's even more for the end time after Christ returns, when there's nothing left, both of the physical city, but also of the system it represents. Okay, that was a longer lesson than you wanted necessarily, but I wanted to make clear, we are aware that the Persians and didn't utterly destroy the city right then. It continued for centuries, but eventually these prophecies were fulfilled even before Christ's return. Okay, so moving ahead, if we look at chapter 50, verse 17, Israel is scattered like sheep. Lions have driven him away. First, the king of Assyria devoured him. Now, at last, this Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, has broken his bones. So this was fulfilled in ancient times. Israel was taken captive by the Assyrians. Then Babylon overthrew what was left of the nation and the nation of Judah. But looking ahead in verse 18, therefore, thus says the Lord of hosts, I will punish the king of Babylon and his land. Verse 19, I'll bring back Israel to his home. There's been a foretype of that. The Jews were allowed to come back after Babylon was conquered. But as far as all of Israel coming back, we look to the time of Christ. You know, look to the second Exodus. And you've heard me talk about that so much, I'm not going to go on more about it. A couple things I like to note. In verse 23, the hammer of the whole earth has been cut apart and broken. That seems to be a poetic reference to Babylon. God called Assyria the rod of my anger, seems that here he's calling Babylon the hammer that he used to smack things and break them apart. That fits with the prophecies that God gave Daniel. Basically, remember, Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon was the head of gold in that statue. And it was by God's decree that Babylonian Empire would rule. Nothing was going to stop that. And then they would fall. Nothing would stop that. And the Babylon or the Persians would take over. And I don't have to repeat the progression. But it reminds us, as several of these verses do, that God is in control. Look ahead to verse 33. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the children of Israel were oppressed along with the children of Judah. All who took them captive held them fast. They refused to let them go. This is because of God's doing. But verse 34 says, their Redeemer is strong. The Lord of hosts is his name. He will thoroughly plead their case that he may give rest to the land and disquiet the inhabitants of Babylon. So, you know, this reminds us that when God allowed the Babylonians to conquer Judah, he wasn't finished with the people of Judah. He had this long-term plan, you know, well known ahead of time. Reminds me, Justin and I were discussing during the break, one of the things we can derive from the 70 weeks prophecy, as complex as it is and as many questions as we have, it shows that God has a plan. And he knows what he's going to do. He's got a schedule. He just doesn't tell us what it is. You know, famously, Christ told the disciples, no one knows the time of my coming. He said, at a time when you think not is when the Son of Man will come. So there, I don't get bent out of shape trying to count the weeks and days and say, I know when Christ will return. And that doesn't relate to this so much as the fact that God is in control. He is following a plan and he's working it out as he intended. Okay, and I'll note, I commented on this earlier. If you look in chapter 50, verses 44 through 46 are pretty much the same words as back in chapter 49, back in chapter 49, verses 19 through 21. Only here it applies to Babylon, and in chapter 49 it was about Edom. And again, it makes us wonder, is this implying that there's an end time combination of the people of Edom with those who are symbolically Babylon, and so they share the exact same fate? You know, you could make an argument for that. You could also make an argument that Jeremiah wrote some really nifty sounding words that fit God's plan, and he wanted to use them again. You know, and to me that might sound really cheap, but I've done that. I've come up with good writing. I think of, if you go on the church's website, look at summer camps. If you want to look at Camp Ketubic, there's a description there that is almost word for word the same as the description for last year's camp, because it already looked really good. So I just went in and changed the dates and a couple of the little things. You know, I liked the writing. I didn't want to repeat it. Maybe that's some of what Jeremiah was doing. I don't want to rule out that it could be some revelation of how Edom and Babylon are interrelated. I just don't want to say it was such a... I wouldn't say that that's absolutely what it is, because we don't know for sure. Okay, I'm moving to chapter 51. Still the same prophetic utterance. Still the prophecy against Babylon. This could have been one really, really long chapter. If it was, it might rival Psalm 119 for being the longest. But the first verse has a phrase that seems unusual. Thus says the Lord, behold, I will raise up against Babylon, against those who dwell in Leb-Kameh, a destroying wind. What's Leb-Kameh, or Kamai, or however you want to pronounce it? Well, this is a Hebrew phrase that the New King James leaves not translated. We believe it's a poetic reference to Babylon. So we don't think it's introducing some new character. We think it's Babylon. If you were to read this in the Old King James, where it says Leb-Kameh here, it says the heart of my enemy. Okay, because basically that seems to be what the Hebrew means. Or the Hebrew means in the midst of those that rise against me, in the midst of my enemy, which seems to be a reference to Babylon. Again, it's a bit of synthetic parallelism. It's saying the same thing with different words. Okay, I'm going to drop down to verse 6. And I already made a reference, flee from the midst of Babylon. We saw that in previous chapters, and again, I relate it most closely to Revelation 18, verse 4, where it says, come out of her. We see God using Babylon for his purposes in verses 7 through 9, And verse 7, Babylon was a golden cup in the Lord's hand that made all the earth drunk. The nations drank her wine, therefore the nations are deranged. Okay, so this is again a symbolism, a cup of wine. It's not saying literally all the nations are drunk from drinking literal wine. It's symbolic of this ideology. Sometimes God's wrath is pictured with a cup of wine. Other times it seems to be symbolic of false religion. And here, these are some of the places I should have gone to in Isaiah when I was making the case that the condemnation of drunkenness is sometimes also a condemnation of partaking in false religion and false philosophy. But we see that symbolism come up a number of times. Verse 19, we see the portion of Jacob is not like them. He's the maker of all things. I'll just mention that God is calling himself the portion of Jacob. That's another name or term for God, meaning he's the one that Jacob can turn to. And not the Jacob who just has his hand up as a question, but Jacob the nation. But Jacob did have a question.
Chapter 51, would you be able to, I don't know, I was reading verse 8, and I guess I was just confused on where it says wail for her. Was he telling them to, what is it?
Oh, it's saying Babylon has fallen, wail for her, take balm for her pain. It's sort of, remember, we're talking poetically, okay? She's fallen. People can cry and wail and lament because she's hurt. In verse 9, it says, we would have healed Babylon, but she is not healed. So it's basically saying, yeah, there's a grave injury and people want to come and try to heal her and make her well, but that's not happening. So if you put it in the context, it's sort of like, yeah, people are going to be upset, you know, but there's not going to be healing because it's God's design and plan for Babylon to fall. It reminds me again of that parallel in Revelation where it says, you know, that great city that everyone was made wealthy by and they're wailing and lamenting because the beast power falls. Because, you know, the beast power is bad for some people, but some people are getting rich while it's going on. And that applies for Babylon as well. It's good for some people in the present sense. Does that make sense to you? So it's not necessarily saying that we should mourn or wail because Babylon is falling, or that God does. But it's good you call that out, because the poetry especially can leave us wondering about some of these things. I'm looking at verse 13, mentions you who dwell by many waters. That could have a dual fulfillment. Babylon was on the Euphrates River, and there's some speculation that the Persian Gulf might have come up further in ancient times, but still, it's by waters. It has access to the sea, so it was a commercial city. If Rome and the Roman system is the modern version of that, although I don't have a map to show you, of course, Rome is right there in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea, also with access to trade and commerce. So it could be a dual reference to ancient Babylon and the modern version of it. I realize I went from 19 back to 13. Sorry, I'd skipped verse 13. I want to make a reference. I like the, again, more imagery in verse 20. In verse 20 says, you are my battle axe and weapons for war. With you, I'll break the nations in pieces. It's funny, now I've got this image of, you know, Thor getting that axe made in the latest Avengers movie, which that's not what this is about, but you can see a battle axe is a pretty formidable weapon. Many people assume this is referring to Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian army, but there's a question, maybe not. If you look down in verse 24, seems to be continuing the thought, and some people argue that it's not, but it says, I will repay Babylon and all the inhabitants of Chaldea for all the evil they've done in your sight. Is Babylon going to be the one that's broken by the battle axe? And if so, it could be a reference that eventually God will use his people to fight against them. And there's some other scriptures that sort of support that. One is in the book of Micah. I won't turn there, but in Micah chapter 4 and verse 13, Micah 4, 13, it says that Zion will beat in pieces many nations. And some people say maybe that's referring to modern times when the United States and British Empire have defeated nations in the Middle East. And, you know, this area now that we refer to Babylon is modern Iraq. And you might even remember that, you know, a few years ago, we sent armies in there and conquered. I hesitate because, boy, you know, you hate to look at modern headlines and pull it out and say, that's this prophecy. But it's worth considering that there's a possibility in that. Also, Zechariah chapter 14, verse 14. Zechariah 14:14 mentions that at Christ's return, Judah will fight at Jerusalem. So we know when Christ returns in Revelation 19, it mentions the armies of heaven with him. But is the armies of Judah referring to physical people, you know, fighting against some of the enemy? And I'm posing it as a question because I'm not going to claim that I know the answer, but it's worth looking and saying, well, where there's end time prophecy here, where it's dual prophecy, we might have some details that we're not sure where how to put into the big picture. There's where I say Revelation is good for giving us a big picture with a framework, and there are details here that could fit into it. But it's like putting together a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle. You have an interesting piece and say, well, where does it fit? And we don't necessarily have enough of the pieces together to know where each of them fit. And I'm willing to wait. You know, as long as I have the frame, I'm good with that. Although verse 28, let's go there. Verse 28 of Jeremiah 51 said, prepare against her the nations with the kings of the Medes and its governors. And verse 28 says, the land will tremble in sorrow. Every purpose of the Lord will be performed against Babylon. I like that. That brings us back down to ground, saying whatever part of this might be end time prophecy, the mention of the Medes and the city of Babylon reminds us that it was an ancient prophecy. At the time Jeremiah was inspired to write this, Babylon was reaching its peak. But God is, in a sense, saying, okay, later on, they're going to be defeated, and I can tell you who will defeat them and where they'll come from. So God revealed it, you know, ahead of time. There in verse 45, I'm skimming ahead, that remember the flat stone skipping across the pond. Here's another reference. My people go out of the midst of her. Again, like in Revelation 18, verse 4. Come out of her, my people, lest you share in her. I'm going to turn to Revelation 18 so I don't misquote it. Revelation 18, 4. I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins and lest you receive of her plagues. I had it mostly correct. Okay, and verse 47, behold, the days are coming. That could be reference to the ancient fulfillment of the prophecy, but it's a phrase that often tells us it's end time prophecy. And again, I'm happy with saying, oh, okay, I don't have to know which part is end time and which time is ancient, as long as I know that God's working out his plan. Verse 52 is another one, though, that says, the days are coming, says the Lord, that I'll bring judgment. Days are coming, another phrase that often refers to end time. Okay, now verses 59 to 64, I'm going to comment briefly because I think I explained in the previous class that everything from the beginning of chapter 50 to verse 58 of chapter 51, it seems Jeremiah wrote out, or he probably told Baruch, you write this out, but it was on a scroll, and then here it describes that he gives it to a fellow named Seraiah, or Seraiah, who is Baruch's brother. And Baruch's brother is going with the king to visit Babylon, not as in captivity, it's not the fall of Judah yet, but they're going to go there, and so there's this symbolism. Seraiah is supposed to get there, read all of chapter 50 and 51, then roll it back up, tie it to a rock, and throw it out in the river. And he will say in verse 64, thus Babylon shall sink and not rise from the catastrophe that I will bring upon her, and they will be weary. Thus far are the words of Jeremiah. Now you might think Jeremiah must have made sure there was a second copy of this prophecy, or else we wouldn't have it. It would have been in the bottom of the Euphrates and nobody knew anything about it. But we have that, and again, now, this saying, thus far are the words of Jeremiah, I mentioned that I think chapter 44 is probably the last thing that he actually wrote. This was thus far at this point. But having said that, most scholars believe that chapter 52 might well have been written by somebody other than Jeremiah. And I think that's probably true. It's a different style, and Jeremiah 52 is almost identical to a stretch of 2 Kings. Now, I think in an earlier class, I might have said 2 Chronicles without bothering to look, but I've got it written down here. Chapter 52 of Jeremiah is the same as 2 Kings, starting with chapter 24, verse 18. So 2 Kings 24, 18 through 2 Kings 25, verse 30. And what it does is it's a historical chapter. It just talks about the Babylonians come, they besiege the city, They break through. You know, Zedekiah tries to escape, but they catch him and they kill his sons and then put out his eyes. And it lists all the stuff that they take. They destroy the city, they destroy the temple, and all the gold and silver that hasn't been taken, they take, but they also, they break up the bronze pillars and the sea of bronze. It's not a literal sea, but this huge bowl that was made for washing, they break that all in pieces and take away the bronze. It's like, we're going to thoroughly destroy this and take everything that's worth anything back to Babylon. And that's how it ends. We don't know if Jeremiah didn't write chapter 52, who did. Some people speculate that it might have been Baruch, but more commonly they think it might have been Ezra. And so he basically took a copy of what was in 2 Kings and put it here to round out the book of Jeremiah. You guys worn out yet? Can you give me 10 more minutes? I think I want to do an introduction to Lamentations. Okay, and basically we're going to do the five W's. Mostly because of the who and when. Almost everybody agrees that Lamentations was written by Jeremiah the prophet. Okay, so it's here in the English version of the Bible because we think Jeremiah wrote it. We know that he wrote some other laments. It mentions that he wrote a lament for Josiah when he died. Think of Jeremiah 9, verse 1, where he said, "Oh, that my head were waters." Well, there's a discussion of crying here. You know, so this lamentation, this is Jeremiah's style. And it fits with when. We believe Lamentations was written shortly after the fall of Jerusalem. Somewhere between 586 and 587. You know, people argue, a lot of times 585, people say, some 586, some 587 for when Jerusalem was conquered. You know, we narrowed it down pretty closely and shortly after. Let me put a little qualifier. Some scholars think that he might have written some of what's in Lamentations as a lamentation for Josiah, and then he took that writing and spruced it up and added to it to make the book of Lamentations. That fits that discussion that I said earlier about having a good piece of writing and using it again. Okay, then let's move on to the where. There's nothing in the book that tells us where it was written. It's implied that it's written either in or near what was left of Jerusalem. You can imagine Jeremiah sitting in a broken down building, much of which was burned, with tears flowing down his eyes as he writes this. That's possible. You might remember that little town of Mizpah, M-I-Z-P-A-H, where Gedaliah set up his government, you know, when he was made governor. Jeremiah was there for some time. You know, he's waiting for the developments to happen before they go to Egypt. Maybe he wrote it there, which is near Jerusalem. There is even some speculation that he waited till he was in Egypt, in Tapanes, and he might have written it there. Not as much belief that it would have been there, partly because how would we have got it? You know, there's no reference to Jeremiah ever coming back. So I tend to think it was in or near Jerusalem, and, you know, shortly after Jerusalem was conquered. The why is a little more interesting. Well, maybe it's not a big question. Why it was written was to mourn for the fall of Jerusalem. And we could say the fall of the nation. Jews started anciently, and I believe many synagogues today still read this book or parts of it on the day of the year that's believed was the date that the temple was destroyed. It's the ninth month of Ab. And that's abs, like if you've got a six-pack, but only one of them, AB, the ninth of ab. So I got this thing, my son Connor will point to his pectoral muscles, and he thinks those are abs. And we keep telling him, those are not abs. Those are your pecs. Your abs are down here. And he doesn't believe us. For some reason, Sue and I don't know anything about anatomy, but he does. But the ninth of ab is a month, and I'm not sure where it falls on the calendar, but you know, this why, the book sometimes is described as an extreme cautionary tale. A cautionary tale is like a warning, this is what could happen. And it's an extreme cautionary tale of what happens when you break covenant with God. Remember, we've seen in the book of Jeremiah, the warning over and over again. And finally, it's don't pray, talk to the hand, the punishment's coming. And that'll lead into the what. What is Lamentations? Well, it's a lament. It's a lamentation, a sad poem. possibly put to music. A lamentation can be a sad poem or a sad song. Mourning, not as in sun coming up, but M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G, mourning and memorializing, not the city, but the suffering. Now, the city maybe too, but it's memorializing the great suffering of the people. Matter of fact, some people, I wrote this down, it's considered an exploration of the depths of human misery. And how many of you have read Lamentations? It's not something you sit down. I read it the other day because I hadn't read it in about a year since the last time I taught it. You know, and that's a lot of human misery. It's worth noting in the Hebrew order of the Bible, it's not with the major prophets. It's on a scroll called the Writings, and it falls in between the book of Ruth and the book of Ecclesiastes. That's because the Jews, they categorize the books a little bit differently, but that's where it falls for them. A little bit more of what? It consists of five separate elegies. An elegy is L-E-G-Y. And it's funny, I looked saying, I know an elegy is a type of poem. So I looked up the definition and it says, a poem of serious reflection or a lamentation. So the Book of Lamentations is five separate lamentations. But it's worth noting, the composition is very technical and precise. So the writer, which we assume is Jeremiah, is applauded by Hebrew scholars for how carefully he put it together. Each of the first four chapters is written as an acrostic poem. Somebody say what an acrostic is? Okay, yeah, only in this case, it's like Psalm 119, only there it stands as, but each it goes through the Hebrew alphabet. So the Hebrew letter for A begins the first verse. The Hebrew letter for B begins the second verse. The Hebrew letter for C. So there are 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet, 22 verses. Okay, so it's carefully done. Except, I should note, the last chapter has 22 verses, but is not an acrostic. And the answer to why is I have no idea. We should also note the third chapter is twice as long. It's still an acrostic, but it goes twice as long as the others. As I said, Hebrew scholars applaud it as rich and elegant, its use of beautiful imagery. And it has a tempo. It builds to a climax in the middle, right in the middle of the third chapter, and then has a decrescendo. Modern scholars have given labels to each of the four chapters for what they portray. And this might help you just to know, chapter one has been called the mourning widow. And again, not mourning as in AM, but someone who's in mourning. So, and it recognizes that Jerusalem's disaster came as a result of breaking covenant with God. So it portrays a widow in mourning. Chapter 2 has been called the ravaged daughter. So it's like portraying someone who's been, subject of an assault, but it's describing the destruction of the city. That was chapter 2. Chapter 3 is called the afflicted man, describing the personal suffering, and it seems to be the personal suffering of Jeremiah, but if so, it's symbolic of the suffering of all those people. And I will note, as I'm going to turn there and read a couple verses, in the middle of this is the small glimmer of hope, the little bit of happiness that can be seen in this book. But before we go there, chapter 4 is called the children's starvation. Children's starvation, describing the effect of a long siege where the food has run out and people are starving to death. And chapter 5 is sometimes called the forsaken orphan, a forsaken orphan, which it does express remorse for sin and there's a cry out for relief. I was commenting, and actually you would think Lamentations is a book you'd almost never turn to, but there's some verses that when I'm really depressed, I find helpful. Starting in verse 21 of chapter 3, where it says, "This I recall to my mind, therefore I have hope." Verse 22, through the Lord's mercies, we're not consumed, because his compassions fail not. They're new every morning. And that's something, at the end of Gone with the Wind, that famous phrase, tomorrow is another day. If you guys haven't seen Gone with the Wind, you really should. But it's the way for us. God built it into us. We're on this circadian rhythm where The sun coming up, starting a new day, gives us a sense of hope. I've had that. I remember back when I was a teenager and I had a breakup with a girl. It seems kind of silly now, but I remember staying up all night listening to sad records and all that. But the sun came up the next day, and it's like, it's a new day. God's mercies are new every morning. There's a new chance. He goes on, the beginning of verse 23, great is your faithfulness. Skip to verse 25. The Lord is good to those who wait for him, to the soul who seeks him. It's good that one should hope and wait quietly for the salvation of the Lord. And it's good to wait. Just a couple more verses. Verse 31, the Lord will not cast off forever. Nothing is forever as far as punishment. Yes, though he causes grief, yet he will show compassion according to the multitudes of his mercies. For he does not afflict willingly, nor grieve the children of men. And this is a powerful stuff in the midst of exploring the depths of human misery. This is a message that's there. God doesn't afflict willingly. His mercies are sure. The sun's going to come up and start a new day. That's something I think worth keeping in mind whenever you're down and depressed. There are places in the Bible that remind us that we still have hope. And with that, we'll put a close to Jeremiah and to this week of school.